Good morning, good evening, wherever you are. Welcome to episode 32 of the Cloudcast. We're coming to you live from our massive Cloudcast studios here in Raleigh, North Carolina. You know, riding shotgun today, I brought back an old friend of the show, Christian Riley, recently self-appointed president of the API Cloud. So, Christian, welcome back, man. Good to have you on the show.
Thanks, Brian. Great to be here.
And, you know, one of the discussions that's come up a lot sort of outside the show, but of people around the cloud space is all about APIs. And what do APIs mean? You know, when people talk about APIs, what is it, you know, you hear certain words. So we thought, you know, we're going to go out and we're going to get the folks who are as good at APIs as anybody. So today we're really excited to have Sam Ramji, VP of Strategy at Apigee, joining us today. Sam, welcome aboard. Thanks for coming on.
Hey, thanks, Brian. Thanks, Christian. It's a pleasure to be here.
And, you know, one of the things I do sometimes when I host the podcast for a topic that I'm only vaguely familiar is we bring on co-hosts other than Aaron. So the reason we brought on Christian today, other than just being a good guy, is Christian's got some good experience having worked with Apigee. So I'm hoping we get a good both technology discussion and, you know, where the world's going from an API perspective from Sam, but also from an end user practitioner. Christian, I'm hoping you're going to jump in and sort of tell us where the bugaboos are and what works and what's great and where to avoid things. So, guys,
Christian has really pushed the boundaries on what enterprises are doing with APIs. So you couldn't have a better person to tell you the nitty gritty.
Very cool. Let me do this. Sam, you have a really interesting background. I just jumped in and introduced you, but tell us about your background, because I think once people understand your background, we're gonna understand why this is a really interesting conversation and good story.
All right. Well, you know, I started programming when I was about 9, so if you're keeping track of the years, that was 1980 on a Commodore PET 16K with no built-in tape drive. So I haven't been able to get away from computers since then. I got my degree in cognitive science, which is a blend of artificial intelligence and neuroscience at UC San Diego, and got to spend a little bit of time near the supercomputing center there. So just been thinking about and doing programming for an awful long time. Then I did a lot of programming on client machines, programmed on Macs and Windows. Actually started life as a Mac and Windows programmer. And then ended up in distributed computing. So dealt with a lot of different API surface areas over time. So APIs for me have gone from, you know, meaning operating systems level calls to distributed systems calls to then I served at Ofoto as director of engineering. We built out an HTTP plus XML infrastructure that connected a lot of different players in the digital images world back in 2000. Connected Microsoft, we connected Hewlett Packard, Sony, a number of different players. And that's where this power of open protocols and very simple networking and documents really sort of caught my attention. Okay. Then I got to work at BEA on, you know, and I apologize for all the work that I did there on SOAP and trying to drive SOAP adoption. But then I ended up at Microsoft looking at large-scale platform strategy, what developers really need. And after all that time, I guess I've come to a very simple perspective on APIs. APIs are something that lets you, as a developer, use a platform to do what you want. The simpler the API, the quicker the time to the first call, quicker the time to value, the more broadly it's going to be adopted.
Okay, very cool. And you know, for anybody listening to the show, the Wired magazine just did a really nice article about Sam. So it talks about his background, talks about your time at Microsoft and trying to drive open source over there. So I won't sort of overlap that. But if people want to get some information of a kind of where you came from in the industry, I'd recommend going to look at that. The link will be off the webpage. So let's just start with the basic stuff. So you talked about, you know, APIs, about, you know, distributed systems and so forth. What's different today in the web world than it was in the OS world? I mean, like, conceptually, as a developer, how do you think about it when you're really connecting sort of anything to anything? It's not just physically located. It's not just how does that change?
So you don't have a dependency on having to know how to install the software, and you don't have a dependency on having to manage your own file system, storage system, database, etc. The best phrase on how the internet's currently working is, I think, from the well-known futurist Tim O'Reilly, who talked about you know, small pieces loosely joined, and the idea of being able to borrow all of the know-how that people have on how to grow their own databases, how to scale their own services, and to just be able to borrow that through an HTTP connection really changes the game. If you think back in the Windows and Macintosh world in the 90s, you had a level of simplicity and control because all of your code was going to run on the same machine. All of the data was going to run there. If you were a programmer, you could hit F5 and run your application and all the dependencies would get assembled and you were basically done. But there were a lot of things you couldn't do. You couldn't step into an existing large user base. You couldn't just connect to Facebook with 750 million users and have the opportunity to get virally adopted and spread across a community like that. So the things that people now have to worry about are, you know, what about the latency of those connections? Now that your app doesn't just run on one device, you now have sort of this weakest link architecture where one weak link will give you a lot of app latency. And it could be that one of your providers decides that you're not worthy of connecting to them anymore, or that you've exhausted your rate limits. So there's a new set of concerns, but on the whole, people are able to write much more powerful applications much more quickly than we could back in the sort of single PC or even the client-server era.
Okay. So we're sort of fundamentally, I think, you know, the earlier days of the internet was, you know, guys like Fred Wilson, the venture capitalist out in New York City, used to say, like, we live in a links, you know, the economy's all about links and clicks. I think what you're starting to drive to is we're really moving towards an internet economy that's about APIs and the how much interconnection you've got between your application and new forms of data, new markets that you couldn't get into before because you didn't have access to that. There was, you know, all these relations. I mean, is that a fair assessment? We're really moving towards an economy of, you know, APIs and the interconnection of those APIs?
I think it is. I think it's absolutely true. I think the twin to that is the app economy. And if you look at what Forrester Research is doing, there's a couple of really, really smart guys there that I admire, John Reimer and Jeffrey Hammond. And they've put together a lot of the thinking that many of us have shared, I think, over the last couple of years into a couple documents on the open web. It's maybe a little bit of a misleading topic, but the larger arc, they call it, is the app internet. So I think that's kind of a sophisticated way to go. We've gone from the web internet to the app internet, and that changes everything. All of a sudden, you are not in control of the code that is generating your user interface. Yep. Somebody else is writing that. Because the math doesn't work when you start looking at how many different devices you need to go and support to hit all the consumers you want. Think about Netflix, 400 different device types from something like 70 different manufacturers. There's no way that one company could effectively create great experiences on all those devices. But through their API strategy, they've been able to push the work to the right place. They've been able to let third parties do the great experiences, but they've also been able to create a consumer service that spans all of those, which makes the whole ecosystem work very efficiently. So it's absolutely a data sharing, a transaction sharing, machine-to-machine internet that's showing up. And then the layer above that 90% of the iceberg mass that's below the water, that's the apps that millions and millions of consumers and even enterprise end users are starting to use as their primary source of computing.
Gotcha. So, you know, a lot of times we think about like APIs in the context of web services and web scale application. Christian, you guys build bridges and airports and you know, like, what, how are you? You're a customer. Well, you're a friend of Apigee. You're a customer. You're helping those guys. Like, what are you doing in the enterprise with APIs? Where does that make sense for you guys? How are you getting engaged with sort of this economy, this new form of technology?
So, yeah, it's a good question, Mike. You know, what's interesting is something that Sam said there. I just want to just pick up on one thing before I answer your question directly on that. But I think what's kind of interesting is that, you know, if you listen to Sam explain the sort of the genesis of the movement of things there, I think what's really interesting to me, and maybe, you know, Sam, you can chime in on this, but it seems that in this kind of API and app economy, the asset shifts from being the application itself to being the API. And if you kind of think about what that really means, you know, you have an asset like a Netflix API, or you have an asset like a Twitter API, which of course the asset then is the gateway to all the data that's behind it. And the UIs are really these kind of throwaway, reusable, lightweight elements that really no longer have the same levels of investment or longevity that the traditional application had. So would you think that was, just before I answer that question, Brian, would you say that was a fair assessment, Sam?
I think it's a great assessment. We never want to underestimate the value of the last mile, but the fact that those components now can be thrown away, can be discarded, can be built for a very low cost, offers a lot more range of experimentation, right? You couldn't have had a shotgun theory with a desktop application 10 years ago because it's going to take you 18 to 24 months to build it. It's going to take you a dozen engineers. It's going to take you a bunch of QA. You're going to have to support it in all sorts of ways. Now you can build an app that represents some of the features of your backend service of your business exposed through your API. With a couple of developers, maybe two, three developers, you can build an app in 2 to 3 months. And then if it doesn't work, no big deal. It's an experiment. If it does, then great. But even then, a new device is going to come along in 6 months, and then your old one will be history. So there's a much higher level of fluidity at the app layer now than there used to be, which means that the API has to be a lot more stable, and the API does become the long-term asset.
So let me see if I can tie an analogy to that and tell me this is on the mark or off the mark. So is it somewhat similar to let's say you're a company and you're selling stuff, you could build your own sort of direct sales force, and you've got the cost that goes with that. You're trying to exactly tell the world how you're going to communicate your message, how you do business. Or you could take sort of like an indirect Salesforce approach, which is I can have lots and lots and lots of people who are sort of accessing my business indirectly. I'm going to be getting sort of multiple forms of feedback to help me adjust and tweak what I do. And like you said, if some of them don't work out, the cost of kind of getting rid of them isn't that big. Is that a fair analogy? It gives you like a ton of flexibility in terms of not having to be perfect in your market, of knowing exactly what your market's going to do. You're going to have natural feedback loops, and you've got a lot more flexibility.
That's a very powerful analogy. And to underscore it, it uses the same architecture we've talked about at the business layer. It allows decoupling of your business cycle and all the different indirect agents that may want to use it.
Okay. So Christian, what's the enterprise? Why do the enterprises care about APIs?
So, I think it's interesting. Again, you go back to this kind of the previous world, arguably the pre-cloud world, where enterprises are mired in legacy technologies, some that Sam will be extremely familiar with his background, whether that be BA, Microsoft, whatever it is. And, these kinds of applications built on those kind of platforms served a fantastic purpose, in the kind of the client-server world, and then in the kind of the early web world. But then as the consumerization bug took hold and mobility grew exponentially, and we're seeing that from an enterprise perspective in our work, mobility is really where it's at. And that sort of whole, legacy application set, if you were to try and take that as a client server app or as a 1.0 web app, the usability and the kind of the look and feel and the experience of putting that as a browser-based app or, kind of a Citrix-based app on a mobile device is kind of not quite where you'd want to be in terms of the overall usability and acceptance of that. So where we went with it was we looked at sort of, where the whole thing was going in terms of consumerization. We'd done a lot of work, as you guys probably know, on building up the kind of the platform as the kind of the private cloud environment, which was a multitude of sins behind the scenes in the application space. But then when you get to this, where the rubber meets the road, that people don't want applications, they want information. And that actually drives a whole different mindset when you deal with mobility, because the people who are on mobile devices, they don't want that full application experience that somebody in a desktop or a laptop environment sat in an office might want. So when you start dealing with information versus applications, it makes you think very differently about how you would provide access to that information. And then, of course, you start to build up this question of, well, I can't move the whole application cost effectively. I can't rewrite it. What should I do? And then the light goes on and you think about, well, APIs might be the way to do that, because I can then selectively expose either read-only or writable components with APIs that don't necessarily have to replicate the entire application. And then back to what we said before, these lightweight UIs that allow you to write very quick, in some cases, very simple interfaces to either get or put data from field. And when we say field, we mean sort of construction sites, as you mentioned. Then being able to do that with the asset, again, being focused on the back end and being able to very quickly iterate, using totally different development methodologies, away goes waterfall, in comes Scrum and Agile. And it's a very, very different world. And we've had some great success in sort of working with Sam and the guys at Apigee to build the API platform, and then to hire some pretty red hot developers in the iOS and Android space to help us build those UIs.
Very cool. So in theory, could could you be doing some things? You guys obviously work globally. You work internationally. You've got language issues. And, I mean, can you build a sort of an API strategy or an application strategy that says, I'm using the same sets of data, I'm using common APIs, and then it's just, you know, let people kind of find that UI that they like, and that to them looks like the application, but under the covers you're able to reuse a lot of things? Is that, I mean, is that a possibility?
Yeah, that, I mean, that's absolutely the case, you know. And then I'm sure Sam will touch a little bit about on the notion of API virtualization, which is kind of, I would say, the next generation of thought process around mashups, which is a very interesting set of constructs that we can talk about later in the call. But yeah, certainly, I mean, absolutely, that's the whole purpose of it. You know, we spend a lot of time on the API, making sure that's solid, you know, adapting the best practices around APIs, which are not necessarily something that enterprise developers have got a lot of experience with. You know, when you kind of move from an enterprise into a Twitter or you know, kind of a Netflix, it's very different about how you deal with APIs and you know, deprecating, should I deprecate, should I not? All sorts of interesting challenges around that. But absolutely, I mean, the idea is to you know, kind of make the API as stable as possible, as quickly as possible, and then iterate on the UIs as and when people need to add, you know, sort of different looks and feels and maybe even different functionality.
Okay. Cool.
So if I can make a comment, if there are enterprise architects or enterprise IT folks listening to this call, you can learn a lot from just hearing the shift in Christian's language from what we might have expected to hear from a senior guy in a major multinational corporation talking about IT a few years ago to today. His language and the system he's evoking are much closer to how you would think about Facebook or Twitter, where instead of projects taking years, they're taking months, and instead of thinking about IT as standing up one application at a time, doing all the due diligence, all the heavyweight requirements that we used to have to do, instead thinking about IT becoming responsible for having platforms, for exposing the business itself as a platform, starts to fundamentally change the speed at which business can be done. And one of the most educational things for me in working with Christian and his team at Bechtel is to look at their organization from the point of view of partnerships drive all of their business. They do dozens of new partnerships every single year to drive their business. So from one construct, we've been talking about APIs and how they enable apps. From another point of view, an app is almost like an implementation of a partnership. So if you're in a situation where you have a lot of partnerships that have to come and go, that those are fluid and flexible, an API is going to enable you to have a much richer, faster turnaround in all of your business development and in all of your partner business activities.
Okay. So I want to jump into the technology piece a little bit, but I want to hold off on that for a second because I think there's probably some very cool stuff to talk about. But I want to talk to that business angle for just one more second. You know, in the Wired magazine article, there's some talk about Bloomberg opening up their data. There's some reference to folks like GM OnStar who want to open that up to services. Can you talk? And I want to dive into Apigee a little bit. Talk to me about what that conversation looks like when somebody like that, who, you know, was very protective, I mean, their natural culture was to be protective of their information, of their assets, comes to you and says, I need help going through this transformation. I want to open up my information because I think there's more value in it. I need a partner in understanding how the technology works. Walk me through both what Apigee does in that space, but more so, you know, how does that business conversation take place?
It comes from the point of view of a product manager, a product officer, a business development executive saying, I have a problem in my business. I just can't get to enough of my partners, or I can't get enough of my consumers because we can't get the development time from IT to focus on all these different scenarios. And we keep coming back with, you know, 6-month, 12-month, 18-month backlogs. And then they start looking at what happened with the iPhone, what's happened with Android, and because, as Christian mentioned, the consumerization of IT is a real thing. We're not two people, we're one person, you know, as a human being. So what you learn as a consumer, you take into your expectations into your business phase. They're realizing that there's some massive wave of adoption that they think they could be participating in, but they're not getting the benefit right now. So they usually have a growth strategy. For the GM OnStar folks in particular, they realize that we spend at least as much time in our cars in general as we do on our phones. And all of the car electronics makers are now putting graphical visual elements in the middle of the dashboard. So shouldn't they be able to have an iPhone-like market? Shouldn't they have an iPhone-like experience? Now that comes into conflict, as you mentioned, with their history of dealing with privacy and security and not sharing their data for regulatory reasons, but also for just, I'll call it psychological reasons. So there is this old guard psychology that says, I have to hang on to my data with both hands and never let anyone else see it, because who knows what might happen. The way that we help them through that conversation is twofold. One, we say, look, there's a new world of open data. And on the one hand, it means that you have huge advantages in being able to find out real things about the market. When somebody asks you for data, when somebody makes an API request, that's a signal from the market that tells you somebody valued this at this point in time, at this at this location on this particular device. That market data is incredibly effective just for driving your own internal operations. That's data that you can't buy from anyone. It's also data that you could sell as a new data product on a data market. So that's one half of it. The other half of it is that open and secure and private don't have to be in conflict. So using approaches like OAuth, which is like kind of the best invention so far of security for a platform business model, and other similar approaches, you can have your cake and eat it too. You can create an open environment that's easy to connect to, that's easy to learn and easy to understand, but is only going to expose the data that you're extremely comfortable exposing based on authentication and authorization and all the things that the chief information security officer is used to. So wrapping all of that up, we're able to talk about some of the effective market impacts that customers of ours have had, like Netflix, like MTV, like AT&T, and others. And that starts to make people feel pretty comfortable that we're serious about enterprise-grade security, enterprise processes, and still helping people use the advantage of speed that you get out of an API platform and enabling a platform business model.
Okay. And
does that make sense? Is that by hitting at your question?
No, I think it absolutely makes sense. I mean, in general, we've sort of moved from we went from a factory economy to sort of people and productivity economy, and that concept of open data, I think, is pretty powerful. And it's probably that mindset of going, as a business, maybe we're a brand new business, or maybe we're an existing business, but everybody's collecting it, and it's figuring out, like you said, not what do you do with the data, but how do you better get into a market? How do you deal with this transition of where people are spending their time, how they're interacting with each other, and then figuring out, is there a way for you to uniquely get into those venues, those markets, those conversations?
Right, and to make that concept accessible, Google was the first open data company. Right. What they did was they enabled all the searches from all over the web and gave people value back. But what they sold was the metadata on the search. Right. If you think about metadata, the simplest form would be a histogram. What are people searching for most? That all of a sudden becomes important, and that generates the concept of having real estate and then matching that with inventory. So you can start to look at Twitter from that same perspective. It doesn't matter what the full set of all videos that anybody happens to be tweeting on the web at a given time is. What's really interesting is, what are the top 20? What are the top 100? What are the top 20 bounded by a particular hashtag or a particular subject area? That's metadata. So as we start to look at that applied to financial services, not what's the full set of every stock ticker being traded right now on a market feed, but instead what are the top referred stock tickers? What are the top 20? What are the top 100 at a given moment in time? That starts to very much change, I think, our sense as vertical industry managers or as business people, how much opportunity there is still available. Google was just sort of the first wave of open data business models, and we're going to see the next 10 years will be heavily led by companies that figure out how to take this concept and apply it effectively to their industry.
Okay, so you and this is where we may get a little bit into the technical weeds. Christian sent a tweet out before we did this, and he said, "Yeah, we're going to talk about APIs. We're going to talk about Apigee." And there was this flood of sort of follow up tweets that was like, "Talk about this from an open perspective. Talk about this aspect." Let's dive a little bit into the basics of this. I mean, we hear REST and SOAP and XML and JSON and Java API. I mean, like, just give me the 101 version of that. If somebody says, well, we have a REST API, does that mean anything? I mean, is there, like, we hear about the Amazon API, we hear about, help me translate between just the protocol and, like, how standard APIs are becoming or how open APIs. What do people kind of have to know at a 101 level to make sense of all this?
Sure. Okay, so here's my best take at an API 101. When somebody tells you they have a REST API, what that means is they've got an HTTP or HTTPS accessible API that is, at this point in time, probably going to give you JSON or JavaScript object notation formatted data back in response to a query. They may also give you XML. A query is going to be structured just like any other HTTP resource. It's going to have a URI. So, you know, if we were to look for a set of podcasts from the Cloudcast, we should be able to go to, you know, api.cloudcast.net/, and ideally here we'd have a version, like let's say v1, so that you wouldn't break old clients, and then you'd have another slash, and then you might have podcasts. And then off of that, you might want to be able to search into the metadata around a podcast. So you might want to look for all podcasts with Christian Riley. So you might say, question mark or Q equals, Christian Riley. That response should bring you back something that's not really human readable. It won't bring you back HTML. It should bring you back a little bit of JSON or a little bit of XML, sort of nicely formatted data that indicates all of the data about those podcast records, indicate that it's successfully linked back to the tagged Christian Riley, and the receiving program should be able to parse that information and then offer you some kind of graphical interface, should be able to let you access the resource underlying it automatically. So in this case, those records might also indicate a link to the MP3 file that represents the actual audio stream.
Okay.
So in terms of openness, what's mandatory is that you use open protocols. You need to use things that are both open and free, that require no royalties, so that you can have proprietary and open source implementations that has been proven to maximize the adoption of any given API. Okay. So HTTP is open, JSON is open, XML is open, no royalty payments have to be made, and you can get, again, proprietary or open source libraries, programs, systems to be able to support all of that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. So where does Apigee fit into that? How do you guys make money if there's it's free, but there's ways to support you? Or help me get a picture of what the economy of, or the economics of being in the data economy mean.
So it turns out that open systems are the best ways to create economies. So there are going to be many, many companies that are able to improve the performance of the API and app end-to-end chain. Apigee is just one of those. What it means for us is we can implement those open protocols. So we implement HTTP, we implement HTTPS. As a call comes into, let's say, a large provider like Bechtel, we're able to grab the inbound request, we're able to look at it, and then we're able to inspect it for all of the things that you worry about when you open an API. Is this a bad request? Is it an attack? Is the request for a resource that the properly authenticated person does not have authorization for? And we're able to apply a range of policies on the message data right there at the gateway and throw them out and return an appropriate error if they're incorrect. If they are correct, we're able to turn them around, transform those appropriate to reach legacy systems, route them to the appropriate system. Perhaps you're on a sharded or a horizontally partitioned infrastructure, be able to send that request to the right place, and then on the way back out, again, retransform it, paginate, cache, a range of different things. It's very analogous to when you just look at a pure HTTP world. What does F5 do? What does Netscaler do? What does Squid do? These are all things that, or Traffic Server, they've all benefited from the fact that there's an open protocol that as long as you obey the rules of the protocol on both sides of your server, then you can interoperate with any other component in the entire system. So that's why openness produces such strong ecosystems, because the barrier to entry is low, the barrier to achieving interoperability is low, and then the market can decide whether or not you have a useful value add.
Okay. And like you mentioned, there's a number of people that are kind of in that portion of the ecosystem, so Mashery or Level 7 or Twilio, or like, how is there a distinction of the types of activities that you get engaged with? Is there a lot of sort of competitive overlap? What's that market space look like?
I think there's a decreasing quantity of competitive overlap, and I think the big competition is just beginning to surface. The chief architect and technical fellow for WebSphere at IBM this year just published his plans for the year publicly, and he's got 10 things that he calls out that he's going to do. And in that top 10 list is API management from a business standpoint. So I think, you know, this in this early stage, I think most of us as providers get along pretty well together. Okay. One distinction I'd make would be Twilio. It's really not API management. They're quite a different class and quite fascinating. They have started to turn the telecommunications industry upside down by providing a REST-oriented approach to being able to program telecommunications behavior. You can initiate voice calls, build IVR systems, send SMS, receive SMS, all through APIs. The one thing I haven't had an opportunity to mention yet about APIs and REST specifically is REST is super easy to use regardless of what programming language you're using. In the SOAP era, SOAP got along really well with .NET. It got along really well with Java. Never saw significant adoption anywhere else. You won't find good SOAP libraries in PHP. And PHP, even still ahead of JavaScript, is the number one most known, most broadly implemented language in the world because of the ubiquity of the web. If you can't get to a developer that's writing PHP, writing JavaScript, doing copy and paste coding, and has the ability to have either native system support or libraries that'll let them talk to your service, you're out of luck. And that's one of the big reasons that this REST trend has accelerated so fast, and SOAP is really continuing to dwindle.
Right, and it sounds like it's sort of the natural kind of process of the web, where while Microsoft's a presence, or you know .NET's a presence, it's not the thing that's native in the most clients. It's not sort of considered the sort of latest and newest, and obviously, like you said, it doesn't have necessarily maybe all the open characteristics that some of the other ones did.
Right. So a couple other sort of players to mention in the industry are Mashape, which is building an API marketplace, and then there are companies like InfoChimps and Factual that are building data marketplaces. Currently, they're more data catalogs than marketplaces because there's not a lot of financial transactions going back. But you can get a little bit of a shape of the future. And the nice thing about that is, again, somebody who just is going to hack a little PHP can use Twilio to make voice calls, send messages, receive SMS, do teleconferences, and maybe bring that combine that with Factual's APIs or one of the APIs that they found on Mashape or on Programmable Web, another API catalog worth mentioning, and build a really cool, interesting application.
So, Sam, if I could just dive in for 1 minute, just because I want to just pick up on one thing you said there, which is kind of, I think it's interesting from a shift perspective, but it's also interesting into an acquisition that you guys have recently made. So maybe you can help me understand why the two come into play there, if they do. But if you think about what I mentioned before about enterprises, and they've grown up in a world of Active Directory and kind of a very comfortable environment that does a pretty good enterprise version of single sign-on, with Kerberos in and of itself. But then when you move away from that into this mobile or this sort of disconnected from the traditional enterprise world, you get into these things around single sign-on using SAML for web apps, and then you get into this whole notion of OAuth that you talked about, which is, kind of typically an application talking to another application on behalf of the user. So if you kind of think about that a little bit, obviously that's going to be a challenge in and of itself for enterprises to understand just how different that is from what they're used to in terms of authentication and authorization and whatnot. But you guys just acquired a company called UserGrid. So I'm guessing by the name alone, there's some kind of user play in that. Can you share anything with us that might help people understand where you're going with that?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that's neat about being a small company is that you can move quickly. So, over the last couple of years, we've learned from our customers as we solve one problem, such as API caching and proxying with the gateway, we uncover another one, which is where we ended up building out a data center to our business. As people started finding there's so much API traffic going through, we'd like some analytics on that. So we built out an analytics platform. The other problem that we started finding showed up frequently is you think about LDAP, you think about Active Directory. Yes, they're pretty scalable systems, but they're also not built for 30 million things. right? If you think about a successful API program, you should end up having 30 million things in it that have different authentication data, that have different authorization data, and the records are going to change very frequently. Furthermore, as you start looking at the difference between API security and web security, with API security, you no longer have a concept of sessions. You now have to pass a token on every single request, and for every single request, that token needs to be validated in case the user's access was revoked or modified or something happened, the app's access was revoked or modified between the one request and the other. So you end up with this massive scalability challenge. What we've done with UserGrid is a means to solve that. UserGrid is an open source project. It will remain open source as part of Apigee, and it heavily leverages Cassandra, which, as you know, is the incredibly scalable open source database that Facebook donated to the world. Based on that, we're able to solve for the problem where enterprise systems were built for just being able to handle maybe a few dozens, tens of thousands, possibly even a few hundred thousand entities in an LDAP store or an Active Directory database, and scale that gracefully to millions without having to overburden your backends. The second thing it does is we've recognized that mobile developers, as you think about the API as the basis of the asset, as you called it, Christian, that's not always enough for a new app to get built. So, you know, let's take an app that you might build to do inventory management for parts that have been delivered to a job site. It's possible that the bulk of that is completely enabled by the old service that you've now wrapped in an API. But the app developer building that JavaScript or Objective-C or Android-based app might also need a little bit of custom storage. They might need to have an additional level of user authentication. They might have users that only use this app that don't need to be included in other enterprise security. They might also have to have a lot more different object management, right? Things that aren't created in your API. So they're starting to use your API as a third-party API, and they still need what we call a mobile backend. So normally what's been happening is people have had a JavaScript or an Objective-C developer, and then they've partnered up with a Ruby developer building a cloud-side custom backend and then running that on Heroku or maybe a Python developer running on Google App Engine. That represents inefficiency for mobile developers. So with UserGrid, we've again leveraged Cassandra to create highly scalable storage and management of generic objects, of custom objects, of users, of activity streams, allowing search across all that information, all through the power of an API. So UserGrid is implemented experienced as a set of REST APIs that a mobile developer will use to store all of the custom data that's specific to their application, and not have to worry that that application is going to slow down or suffer as it scales up. I hope I've done a reasonable job of explaining, but I'm sure that I've left something out, and you may have an additional question or two.
No, I think it's good. It's sort of new to me. The analogy that jumped out at me is it feels like it's sort of like when you go through the airport with TSA, you get checked for your ID when you walk in the building, you get checked for ID when you go through the gate, you get checked for ID when you go on the plane, and all these sort of additional transactions of essentially very, very similar stuff. You're like, why do I need all that? Shouldn't there be a system in place that checks me once at the front door, recognizes who I am and all the activities I do, and then efficiently gets me through? And I think that's sort of, to a certain extent, what you're saying that UserGrid provides is that sort of overall knowledge or overall linkage so that we don't have all this friction for every single step, which obviously impacts scalability.
Yeah, that's part of it. But the other thing that we're helping people with is a number of applications have suffered from catastrophic success. So you've got an app, you've got 10,000 people on it. You've written your own custom backend. It gets written up in TechCrunch. Now all of a sudden you've got 100,000 users, and then you've got 200,000 users. And all of the nasty scale issues that show up at very, very high levels but never show up at low levels bring down your system. Users can't log in. They can no longer, instant message each other through your application. They can no longer access common storage or whatever it is that your application is trying to do. That's not a great outcome. So to be able to remove any concern about the back-end scaling or even having to do much design of the back-end and push that capability back towards the app developer to say, yeah, sure, I want single sign-on. I want to be able to have scalable authorization, and I want to be able to survive scaling up from not very many to millions of users. That's the key technical challenge I think that we've been able to help overcome. Along with that, you end up wanting to store lots of custom objects. If you're writing a very common app that people write is an app for an event. So let's say we're going to write an app. Let's say we're throwing President of the API Cloud's birthday party, and it's going to be a 3-day event, and we're going to have great speakers from all over the world. We're going to have wonderful after parties, and we're going to have thousands of people show up. If you're really slick, you should have an app for that. It should run on your iPhone, should run on your iPad. You might even have a web interface. How are you going to create the back end that in a graph-like manner enables you to link all of the events, all of the attendees, all the recommendations, the activity streams, the questions to moderators, I'm going to this cool party, how great is that? That's not easy and represents the bulk of the cost of event apps these days. All that stuff gets managed just by writing, by making API calls against UserGrid instead of having to think through and build that entire system yourself. So we're just trying to make it way, way cheaper to write mobile apps, and we think the right way to do that is through an API. So you'd use UserGrid for your first party, for your first party app storage, and then you'd use the existing Apigee infrastructure for accessing your third party APIs, whether they were Facebook or Twitter, or whether they were private APIs that you can only access because you have a partnership.
So I guess, Sam, to an extent, it sounds a little bit like the iCloud APIs, this kind of key value notion and sort of arbitrary data. Is that probably a good assessment?
Great analogy. The key value is very horizontal, and then we've specialized that in a few cases for things like activity streams, search, and user management. But we offer a generic key value store for all the objects that you care about in your application.
Very cool. So I like the description, or sort of the discussion about just take an everyday event, which is an event, an activity, an event, and what's it really take behind the scenes to make what everybody thinks is just a small application, but has this massive reach and touch and all those things. So Christian, I'm going to throw the last question to you because we're getting sort of running out of time. We talk all the time on this show about a lot of the stuff is about change and how are people adapting to it. You're obviously in the middle of this as an operator or trying to interact with it. How are you learning this space? How are you communicating it to your management team? What are you finding as good tools for you to get smart about APIs and how APIs work?
Yeah, it's a challenge, because it starts really with the mobile devices driving the strategy, and by that I mean, I would think probably the majority of large Fortune 500 companies now have got those who walk through the corridors of power. They'll be equipped with iPads and iPhones and other things. And at some point, like we had this kind of, revelation probably when I first met Sam, almost a couple of years ago, I guess, that, these are not just toys. No longer are they just things that execs buy because they want to, show off to the wives and what have you. They're real business tools. And as we mentioned earlier in the show, the traditional systems don't make the way onto those new devices very easily. And so with that drive comes a whole renewed vigor within the organization to figure stuff out. I've been very lucky to talk to people like Sam and to work with people like Adrian Cockcroft at Netflix. I mean, no cloud show would be complete without a hat tip to Adrian and the guys at Netflix, of course.
Here.
And so what we've done, I've been out sort of buying every book I can find and listening to every podcast and every one of Sam's prezzies that he pitches up with. This is just phenomenal amounts of information that's really easy to assimilate. But recently I bought a copy. There's a brand new book came out, the API, I guess it's API Guide or something, which is an O'Reilly book, which is written partly by Greg Braille, who's one of Sam's stable mates. He's the CTO at Apigee, and a guy called Dan Jacobson, who was at National Public Radio and ran their API strategy, and he's now been sucked into the great Netflix vortex and worked with the group there. But it's a brilliant read, and the thing about it that's noticeably cool is it's very, very thin for an O'Reilly book, and that's not meant to sound how it sounds, but the great news within the book is that it's very, very focused on the business of APIs, and it's not necessarily around the technology. Some of the things that that Sam's mentioned around kind of the REST and the best practices around APIs in general. It's covered at a high level, but I think it's really great that the book is all about the business of APIs and how you would adopt an API strategy to do some of the things that we've covered on the call today. So, I think it's all about, getting out there, finding as much information as you can, not necessarily about the old API world that we talked about, but definitely this new world of the API and the app economy. And then obviously trying to figure out what that means to your mobile strategy overall, because I think any organization that doesn't have at least their mobile strategy on their agenda could be doing themselves a real misjustice in terms of business opportunity over the next 18 months, 24 months, as this really does gather pace from a consumer perspective and purely from an adoption perspective. So I'll just kick a quick question back to Sam actually on this. Obviously, I've been lucky enough to have this sort of part evangelism role, and I know that's something that you do on an everyday basis, Sam. Do you think we need more of that, in enterprises generally, except in the outliers of the Netflix and the Twitters, of course, but just generally in sort of the corporate world, do you think that we need a lot more evangelism around the business case of APIs as opposed to the technology?
Absolutely. I think we need a lot more evangelism and practice, and I think the best evangelism comes from a marketing or product or business development leader who says, man, I made my number this year, actually beat my number this year because I invested in APIs. But being able to package up those stories, retell them so that people can effectively make the shift, I think is incredibly important. And I, for one, would love to see more active storytelling, more peer mentoring, person-to-person mentoring, especially from people who are trying to lead change from within each of their own companies. Because what I learned at Microsoft, trying to make a small change there to how they thought about open source, was that no person's a prophet in their own in their own country. So you really need to partner up with friends from other companies, people you trust who are succeeding or failing. Right? All lessons I think are very helpful in driving APIs inside the enterprise, because we're going through a Cambrian explosion of applications now, of apps, but we're also going to see a massive extinction of companies over the next 5 to 10 years, just as we did in the web wave. The ones that don't understand how to apply and invest in APIs are not going to be around in their current shape and form, because they're not going to be able to support the kind of consumer and partner engagement that is the mark of the economy we're seeing in front of us. So I think a lot more evangelism is going to be needed so that people can at least see the opportunity and then decide if they're going to participate or not.
Well, very, very cool. For Sam, this was fascinating to me. I'm more of an economics person myself, so this was sort of the economy that I didn't really know about. I sort of knew about the technology, but the underlying piece of it is fascinating. So thank you so much for your time, Christian. Thanks for riding Shotgun Man. It's great to talk to you and have you on. That's it for today. So for Sam and for Christian, thanks to everybody for listening. You can follow us on Twitter at thecloudcastnet, or of course find us on the web at thecloudcast.net. You can send us an email, get all the show notes, or you can follow us on Stitcher. So again, for Sam and Christian, guys, thanks for the time. Thanks for the conversation. Really, really interesting. And thanks to everybody for listening. Have a great weekend.